If you have a decent job, fair pay, safe working conditions, paid time off, health and retirement benefits maybe, you might owe a debt of gratitude to a labor union even if you're not a member. In fact, even if your industry is not unionized. For more than a century, labor unions have helped shape job conditions in the United States and helped balance the power between employers and the workers they hire. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What's most remarkable about the rise of organized labor in this country is how often the people who battled to change working conditions were among the most marginalized, not only at their workplaces, but in society. We're talking immigrants, women, people of color, queer folks, and those with disabilities. Journalist Kim Kelly is here to tell some of their stories. She's an independent labor reporter and author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
What sort of presence did unions have in your life growing up?
Well, I was lucky in that I grew up in a union family. I'm actually third generation. My dad was an operating engineer. My granddad was a steel worker. Grandma's a teacher. The union was kind of always a presence in my life, but kind of tucked into the background, right? Like, my dad wasn't an activist. He just had a union job and he had union health insurance. And it came in handy when my mother got sick when I was pretty young. And it just kind of drove home the idea that unions are a good thing to have. They'll have your back. They will help you when you need it. Because otherwise, as workers, as working class people, we're kind of on our own.
So early in your career working as a journalist, you realized you had like this really cool job, but it wasn't a fair or a reasonable job. How did you get involved with efforts to unionize your colleagues?
Sure. Yeah, that job was, it was a pretty cool job. I don't know if it exists anywhere else in the world at this point, but I was the heavy metal editor for Noisy, which was a Vice vertical focusing on music and culture. And prior to that, like, I've spent most of my life in the music business. I've been a music reporter, specifically a heavy metal journalist, for most of my life up until we started organizing at Vice in about 2015. And at that point, you know, the office was in Brooklyn. People were being paid very low salaries. Everything was always in flux. There's no stability. There are a lot of issues with discrimination and sexual harassment. It might have been a cool place to work, but it was not a good place to work. And so we decided to unionize to try and save the things that were good and try to make things better for us and for workers coming in after us. And it was really just a thrilling experience to organize and then to end up in every meeting and every committee and every bargaining session, to win a successful contract, to build our union, to really feel that power of coming together with our coworkers and changing things for the better. There was really no going back to heavy metal after that.
So that was 2015. Just a few years after that, of course, we entered the pandemic era when huge numbers of workers in many, many industries were suddenly deemed essential by their employers and by society, but their employers were often reluctant to treat them that way in terms of compensation.
Oh, yeah. That was also kind of personal, too, because my partner at the time, he was working on a farm, and later he went to work at a grocery store during the earliest, scariest days of the pandemic. And I would just wait for him to come home and think, like, you are not getting paid enough for this. You are not getting benefits. You are feeding people, you're keeping the world running, but you're being treated like a little robot. And so many people had that experience, right? So many workers whose labor has always been essential to keeping the economy running, to keeping the world on its axis. All of a sudden, they were told, oh, we see you. We know that you're essential. You're important. We're going to clap our hands for you. Maybe a couple of you will get raises. You'll get hazard pay. You'll get a little bit of attention for a little while. And then that dried up. And the applause stopped, and those raises went away. And those workers and their essential labor, they were kind of left in the lurch. And, you know, over the past couple of years, we've started to see workers do something about that.
As this is happening, as more and more people are getting interested in the potential benefits of organization as laborers, some people note this wide range of employment law that now guarantees a lot of, you know, worker protections and benefits that were first won by organized labor, and assume we've arrived at a place when public policy should be enough to ensure that companies treat workers fairly. What tells you that unions are still a critical element in this?
Well, I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that even the important labor legislation that we do have, that was fought for and bled for, that never covered everybody, There were still groups of workers that were left out of some of our most impactful labor laws that were passed in the New Deal era. For example, the National Labor Relations Act, 1935. There were types of workers who were excluded, not just independent contractors, but agricultural workers and domestic workers were explicitly struck out of that legislation because at that point, the majority of people who filled those jobs were Black women and Black men. And Southern lawmakers who were racist, they insisted on excluding those groups of workers from that legislation. And that's still the case today. There are still groups of workers that are not covered by basic labor laws or by any kind of basic labor protections. And, even if they're not able to access the traditional union structure as it stands, workers are still able to organize outside of that. They're able to work collectively, they're able to better their lot. But in terms of why people need unions specifically, why they still matter, why they're not this kind of dusty relic, unions are still the greatest vehicle for working class power in this country. They are still, for so many workers, the only way you can win legal protections and legal rights from your employer. You can get a raise, you can get decent health care benefits, you can get protections and safety regulations on the job. Like, if anything, unions are more necessary now than they've ever been because work itself has changed, the economy has changed, the political landscape has changed. There are very few systems that exist to protect working people in this country. And really, as we've learned over the decades and the centuries, we can only really depend on ourselves. And building a union, building a strong union, getting that strong contract, building that solidarity, that's kind of our only chance to really protect ourselves and one another.
Your very first chapter here focuses on workers who have gone, frankly, unrecognized as critical drivers of labor protections for well under a century, over a century, and that is women. It was women who were the first American factory workers to walk off the job way back in 1824. What conditions were they trying to change?
Yeah, that was, I mean, these were young women too. Like, these are young women and girls. About 102 of them in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, launched the country's first factory strike because they were working in textile mills. They're working these 12-hour work, 12 to 14-hour work days. They were getting paid next to nothing. They're being treated like they were disposable and expendable. And the fact that they were young women specifically meant that their employers didn't feel the need to invest in them. They assumed they would go off and get married in a couple of years. Why should we treat them well? They were assumed to be docile. Their employers thought, oh, they'll put up with anything. And they couldn't have been more wrong. Because on that day in 1824, those over 100 women walked out of the mills and they show and you know, they started what became a much broader movement for textile workers' rights, for garment workers' rights, but they were the first ones to pull that off. And it's just so significant to me, and I think to labor history in this country, that so many of the firsts and so many of the most important moments we've seen in our collective history have been undertaken by the most marginalized workers, whether it's women, Black workers, Indigenous workers, queer workers, people who have been pushed to the margins and told that their labor doesn't matter and their lives aren't important. They have always been the ones who have fought the hardest and pulled us the closest to where we actually need to be.
It's interesting when the book notes that many large-scale 19th-century employers made a point of hiring women and immigrants. Like, without any context, Kim, it sounds like a sort of progressive move, right? Offering opportunities to people who were marginalized in society. But it turns out that marginalization was the point, right? Employers were counting on these particular workers not to think they had any power to object.
Right, because these were workers that didn't have many options. At that point in time, women who worked outside the home, and I should specify white women who worked outside the home, there were really only so many places they were able to get a job. And Irish immigrants, Eastern European immigrants, Italian immigrants, these were workers that had very few options. And those, especially who were immigrants who were coming to this country, they didn't have a safety net. They didn't have a ton of savings. They needed that job. They needed to feed their families and try and scrape together a living. And employers knew that. And they also knew, or at least they assumed, that those workers wouldn't fight back or wouldn't push back or wouldn't have a sense of pride or self-respect that, and they wanted to exploit that. And they tried, and they didn't always pull it off because those workers were not always willing to put up with that.
I was so impressed to learn this story of Black women right after the Civil War in the South demanding better pay for washing white people's clothes. Like, this was the work they did. How did they do that? How did they campaign for better pay and better conditions?
Yeah, and that was the Washerwomen of Jackson, Mississippi, 1866. And they were laundry workers, and they were all Black women because that was, again, the only option for a Black woman who wanted employment at that time, because that was work that no one else wanted to do. Being a laundry worker at that point was miserable, difficult work. This was way before washing machines, let alone, you know, any other modern convenience. And so they got together and they realized, okay, our wages are being kept far too low. We're not being treated with respect. We're not being, our labor isn't being valued. And they were not interested in dealing with that. They thought, well, we're the people that clean your clothes. Without us, you're kind of, you know, up a creek. And they came together with a petition, an open letter they sent to the mayor. And they announced their intention to charge a uniform rate for their labor so that their white employers and their white clients could stop ripping them off. And basically, they named themselves the Washerwomen of Jackson. And with that public action, they basically became Mississippi's first labor organization. Like, they were the first to do that. And of course, they didn't, you know, the newspapers weren't very very sympathetic. They didn't meet very their actions weren't met with a lot of support from those in power, but that it doesn't mean that what they did didn't matter or that it didn't inspire other people to take the same kinds of steps and keep pushing forward.
Lots of people, I think, have heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and know that it has something to do with burgeoning calls for worker protections. What may be less well understood is that the fight did not start with that tragedy, right?
Right. It was building on years of activism and agitation from other garment workers in New York City. One of the women that I write about specifically is a woman named Clara Lemlich. I always butcher it. But she was a Jewish Ukrainian immigrant and she was a lifelong radical. She moved to New York in 1903. And by 1909, she had helped organize this strike called the Uprising of the 20,000, which is, it kind of did what it said on the tin, right? 20,000 garment workers, predominantly women, predominantly immigrants, had, you know, kind of shut down the city because they're sick of being treated poorly, being paid garbage, being treated like disposable nothing instead of, you know, workers deserving of respect. And they went on a massive strike and they forced, I think it was 33 out of 34 of the major garment manufacturers in the city, the major factories, to sign a pledge, basically agreeing to improve working conditions and address some of the issues they'd raised. And one of the outliers who refused to sign that pledge, refused to make those improvements, was the owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And 2 years later, that, you know, that became a very, very apparent that they had not put in that extra effort, because that's when tragedy hit.
Kim, to your point earlier about, you know, the fact that labor laws have never been enough on their own to protect people, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire really helped to telegraph that message, right? That laws alone were not working to protect vulnerable people from abusive and dangerous conditions.
Right. I mean, at that point, this was 1911, right? This was before we had OSHA. This was before we really had any kind of standardized safety precautions or regulations in factories in general. And the conditions that these workers, who were predominantly women, predominantly Eastern European and Jewish and Italian immigrants, some as young as 14, so there were kids in there too, they were working in these choking, dirty, just awful environments that there's no ventilation, there was dust everywhere, there are fabric scraps everywhere. It was a fire trap on any given day, right? And on top of that, the owners had this habit of locking the doors while the workers were inside because they were afraid that workers would maybe take home a couple scraps of cotton. They were afraid of stealing. So they locked people inside these, you know, sweltering establishments. And that's not something you're supposed to be able to do now, at least. But at that point, they could kind of do whatever they wanted. And because of that, when a fire broke out on March 25th, 1911, the people inside, they couldn't get out. You know, there were There was an elevator that broke. There were, God, it's horrible to even just think about or to talk about, thinking about the image of these young women leaping from the windows of the sixth floor factory with their hair streaming behind them, with fire, billowing out from every window and dying on the concrete. It's a visceral, horrific tragedy that happened. 146 people lost their lives. And this was in the middle of New York City. So people saw this happening. People took photos. It was impossible to look away. And that is one thing that really it helped kick into motion some of those labor laws and protections that we eventually saw. But it took a lot of bloodshed to get us to that point.
What sort of inspiration did Frances Perkins take from that tragedy?
She is awesome. Her witnessing that, she happened to be in town that day, right? She was visiting a friend, and she heard news of what was happening and raced over to see what was going on, and she became an eyewitness to the tragedy. She saw the death, she smelled the smoke, she saw those bodies in the concrete, and she took that, and she was already interested in workers' rights and protecting consumers. She was already a social justice minded person, but that really just impacted the entire trajectory of her life and career. She became involved with the Factory Investigating Commission, looking into fire safety. She became the New York State Industrial Commissioner. She worked her way up through the ranks of various local political positions, and eventually, in 1933, she became the first woman to, and definitely the first female labor secretary to join FDR's cabinet. And she had pretty good timing because she ended up being part of one of the most ambitiously pro-labor legislative moments in American history. And so much of that was because of her, because of what she did.
This book is full of stories of people who had really creative ideas for getting the attention of the people in positions of authority. How did workers at this factory in Lawrence, Massachusetts, find like innovative ways to force people to pay attention to their pickets?
Oh, that was during the Bread and Roses strike, right?
I believe so. This is when families of striking workers were also out there.
Yes, that was, man, this was, and you have to, give some a shout out to IWW organizers like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood, who they organized this campaign to send 150 of the town's children, striking children. They shipped them out to New York City and had them stay with supporters and helped, made it a little easier for their parents who were on strike to focus on what they were doing and to have a few less mouths to feed. And of course, that got a lot of attention because that made the bosses, made the bad guys look even worse. And it turned into what had become kind of altruistic, kind of nice publicity stunt that also helped out workers, became a conflict when the Massachusetts police showed up and blocked a train. And not only that, they attacked some of the people on the train. They really violently reacted to what was happening. And that, of course, got national headlines, and a lot of people started paying attention to what was happening in Lawrence because it is hard to spin, to put a positive spin on a story in which a bunch of police start beating up a bunch of kids because they're trying to escape a violent labor conflict.
So, in situations where labor conflicts do turn violent, there's no particular reason why law enforcement should habitually side with management rather than labor. Can you explain some reasons why this might have been the case over and over throughout the course of American history?
I mean, police are here to protect capital and property, not people. That's just the basic gist of it, right? And in terms of, them siding with management, police are management, right? They're part of the boss class. They're not part of the working class. And they've always really, I mean, I'm not a fully trained historian, so perhaps I am wrong, but I would challenge anyone to find an instance throughout history of police ever really siding with the workers when they're going up against the boss, when they're going up against the powers of capital, whether they were, mine guards or armed guards being sent to go to war with coal miners in Appalachia, or whether they were the New York City police who broke Carol Emmerich's ribs on the picket lines in 1909, or the issue or what we're seeing right now in Alabama when the 1,000 coal miners on strike in Brookwood in Tuscaloosa County right now are, being harassed and injured on the picket line while local state troopers turn their heads the other way. It's just they've never been on our side. They've always been the strike breakers, the blacklegs, the mine guards. It's an unfortunate reality of history in this country that, when you think about the eternal labor anthem, which side are you on? It's pretty clear how they would answer.
What did you learn about the history of workers coming together as a class having been hindered by racism, so that black and brown workers trying to secure protections had to do so independent of their white co-workers in the same jobs?
There are so many historical examples of that happening throughout history because, like you said, like it's very apparent the history, I mean, the history of the labor movement is the history of America, right? And that has never been one that treats everyone equally. And for a very long time, black workers and other workers of color had to organize independently of the white-led unions and the white-led labor movement because they weren't in, like welcomed in or they're actively discriminated against. Whether you're talking about A. Philip Randolph founding the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and that becoming the first Black-led labor organization to be kind of federally recognized, or Dorothy Lee Bolden in the '60s founding the National Domestic Workers Union of America and organizing Black domestic workers in Atlanta. She did that not on her own. Of course, she had the power of her own union behind her, but she didn't do that with like the blessing of the white-led labor leaders. She didn't do that with the resources or infrastructure that other established unions had access to at the time. She did that by organizing people, person to person, talking to people she knew because she was a domestic worker. They organized this really strong, really impactful organization and movement that was tied in with the civil rights movement, that was tied in for the fight for voting rights. And was also just so laser focused on professionalizing this industry and lifting up the women that did that work. And it was incredible. But imagine how much easier it would have been for her and for those workers if they'd had more support from white members of the labor movement. Like that's always been the case in this country, that when workers come together across lines, whether they're racial or gender, generational, linguistic, like any time that workers come together, they're so much stronger. That is how we win. That is how we've always won. When workers and leaders specifically give in to these divisions, that's how we break apart. That's how the bosses win. And while that's a lesson that seems pretty simple, right? That is not one that has been learned or held close at every possible moment throughout our history. So it's something worth emphasizing too. Like we are so much stronger together. And shutting people out because of who they are, where they come from, that's just doing the boss's work for him.
People may know of Mother Jones as just a weird title for that left-leaning magazine. Who was the real Mother Jones?
She was one of my favorites. I mean, I named the book after one of her quotes, Pray for the Dead and Fight Like Hell for the Living. But she was an Irish immigrant, a mother, a seamstress. She was a lot of things, but she's known, most like famously for her time as a labor organizer and as an agitator, specifically working with the UMWA, United Mine Workers of America. She was an absolute firebrand, whether she was on the picket lines or she was organizing campaigns against child labor or when she was storming into backdoor meetings with capitalists and giving them hell. Like she was just a really incredible figure and an incredibly effective figure. She was an elderly woman who dressed in black and showed up on the picket lines and had a very, well, motherly vibe. Like she would talk about, grizzled coal miners and crooked politicians as boys. She saw the entirety of the working class as her grandkids. And she had a really fascinating life, but and it really it's worth reading an entire biography of her. But she's just one of my favorites, and she's just an example of a woman who just kind of dove face first into the class war and refused to be shut out, refused to give up, and believed so wholeheartedly in the cause of workers that she allowed herself to be arrested and beaten. She made her life so much harder than it needed to be, and she did it because she loved the workers.
Kim, how did Asian American and Asian immigrant workers band together to change the conditions around agricultural labor conditions in Hawaii?
This is one of my favorites to talk about because so few people know about it, but it's just such an incredible story. So, back in 1946, the Great Sugar Strike. This unfolded because at that point in time, the sugarcane plantations that were a major economic source for the islands were generally owned by white European men who lived in the mainland, and they were worked by a panoply of immigrants and native Hawaiians. It was predominantly Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Filipino workers who were out there slaving away in the fields. And they were part of a union, the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, ILWU. A really fascinating union in and of its own right. But throughout, they've been organizing and striking and fighting for their rights for a very long time. And at earlier points in that history, different groups of workers had been pitted against one of not pitted against one another. Filipino workers were brought in to break a strike by Japanese workers, that kind of thing. The bosses really aimed to foment divisions and distrust between the different groups of workers, to the point where on the plantations they paid different groups of workers differently, and they held workers in different segregated camps. Chinese workers lived here, Korean workers lived here. The whole point was to keep them separated so they wouldn't organize. And when it came time to strike in 1946 against these big five sugar company owners, the union realized, okay, we need to get past this. We need to build some real solidarity. And they brought people together by very consciously embracing the diversity of the people there and making it very clear that every worker was equal and was valued. And so they brought in translators and they made sure that every person knew what was going on, every person felt heard. They built strike kitchens and had different groups of workers cook for one another and share culinary knowledge and build community that way. They built such a strong bond between these different types of workers to the point where they all saw themselves as one instead of different groups. And yeah, that approach worked and they won. They won the strike. They won a huge wage increase. They really just set an important precedent. And it was just really fun to learn about that because I didn't know about that before I started researching this book either. There's so many incredible stories kind of tucked away in different books and academic archives, just waiting for people to find them and bring them to light.
We should also all know the history of how workers with disabilities have organized over time to secure some of the protections we now pretty much all count on at work.
Yeah, that's, man, one of my favorite labor stories to tell people about, and it usually takes them totally off guard. It starts with the fact that the longest federal occupation, like longest occupation of a federal building in US history, was held by disabled activists who were fighting for civil rights legislation, specifically for the enact for okay, this is a lot of legal stuff, right? But the 1977 Rehabilitation Act included this provision, Section 504, which would essentially it was essentially the first piece of legislation that addressed the civil rights of disabled people, like recognized that we are a class of people that deserve to be able to go to work and exist as functional members of society. And the government dragged its heels for ages on actually putting into place these regulations that would have impacted various businesses. And these activists got together, were like, right, we're sick of waiting. We are going to do something about this. And they occupied these health and social services buildings in cities across the country. In San Francisco, they lasted 26 days occupying this building. And they were able to make that work because the Black Panthers fed them. Local church groups came out to support them. When some of those leaders went out to Washington, D.C. to meet with Congress, the Machinists Union showed up with a truck and it provided transportation because at that point there weren't any accessible, buses or subway stops for folks who used wheelchairs and mobility aids. They kind of had to just tie them in and figure it out. And really, disabled activists have been part of basically every labor struggle, right? We've always been here, whether we showed up disabled like I did, or people were made disabled by the jobs they do. And it was really important for me to show the intersections between the disability rights movement and the labor movement because we've always kind of been walking hand in hand, whether or not, people have always realized it.
Kim, recently we've been hearing a lot about efforts to organize Amazon drivers and warehouse workers to form unions to protect their rights and safety. And your book comes all the way up into contemporary times. Tell us about folks you've met who've contributed to these efforts.
Yeah, the very beginning of the book. And really, it's kind of been a through line throughout the whole time I was writing it, because as I was writing the book, I was going back and forth to Alabama. first to document this attempt by workers in Bessemer, Alabama, at an Amazon warehouse there. They tried to unionize with RWDSU, the Retail Warehouse and Department Store Union. And that kicked off in, like, what was it, 2021, 2020? It's been a little while. Essentially, they were the first group of workers to kind of go up against this Goliath and try and organize. And this was happening in Bessemer, which is a predominantly black, lower income area that is, it's really the kind of place that Amazon loves to move into because the workers there don't have a ton of options. There isn't necessarily a strong labor history. Well, there's a strong labor history, but there isn't a lot of pro-labor or pro-worker advocates in the government in that state. Like, it's difficult to be a union member in that state, but it's not impossible, and people do it. And the workers in Bessemer tried. Their first election, it came after a very brutal and union-busting campaign on Amazon's part. They worked overtime to intimidate the workers and try and bust the union. So the first attempt, it failed. They didn't get the votes they needed. And then they started organizing again. And now we're still waiting to hear the results of that second vote. But it's really people like Daryl Richardson who made the call to the union in the first place, or Jennifer Bates, who just this brilliant woman who he's just a really effective organizer and speaker, and she became almost like the mother of the movement. Or younger folks like Isaiah Thomas, who he's 20 years old. Right now he's in college. He throughout his involvement with the union, it changed the whole trajectory of his life. He's now going to school to be a labor lawyer because he was so fired up because he wants to help other people organize and fight for their rights. Like what happened in Alabama, it's so important. Even if they didn't win this first battle, they have kicked off what is going to be a very long war that I really hope that the workers are going to end up winning.
Are unions somehow inherently anti-capitalist?
Well, some of them are, but and I certainly wish more were. But I think that's kind of a complicated question, right? Because different unions have different political outlooks. But honestly, even just when you come down to brass tacks, the interests of labor and the interests of capital are very, very different. They're diametrically opposed. And I don't think, well, there are a lot of unions that might disagree with that, sure. But as someone who has studied unions and who is very much an anti-capitalist, I think some of the most successful and important and impactful unions have recognized that tension and recognized that the employing class has nothing in common with the laboring class and acted accordingly, right? Because it's important to remember that there are way more of us than there are of the capitalist oligarchs at the top. And they can't get anything done without our labor.
Does this feel like a good time to be a labor journalist?
It is so much fun. Like, it's so exciting. It killed me over the past year or so when I was locked in my little office writing my books. I couldn't run off to the picket lines. I couldn't run off here, run off there. But it is really an incredible moment to be interested in labor in general, right? But to be someone who has the deep privilege of documenting this time and being able to lift up workers' voices. I can't think of anything better.
Journalist Kim Kelly is an independent labor reporter, and her book is called Fight Like Hell: The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, this has been really interesting. Thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at KERA Think. The Think podcast is available free wherever you get podcasts. You just have to search for KERA Think and subscribe, or catch up on what you've missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.